It is Tuesday, December 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the FBI says the California shooters were radicalized for some time before they killed 14 people last week. China copes with intense smog, and we look at the new film in the Heart Sea. It's all ahead. The Federal Bureau of Investigation says the husband and wife who killed 14 people and 21 others in California practiced shooting before the attack, and they had been radicalized for some time. An FBI official told reporters Monday investigators are still looking into how long U.S.-born Ed Rizwan Farooq and his Pakistani wife Tashfeen Malik were planning the attack. He said the couple went to several gun ranges to practice, including one time within days of the mass killing at a gathering of local government workers. Charlie is senior research associate at the Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative at Georgia State University. I spoke with him in London. Certainly, her background, she'd spent time in Pakistan, and she had studied at this Al-Huda Center. Looking back on it, though, the implications for international security, is there any way that international officials, and particularly those in the United States, when she came here, you know, that would have triggered any red flags?
I think it would be too difficult and take up too many resources if we were to try and figure out the intentions or the future intentions of anyone coming back from attending an institute like that. Of course, it does seem that this will have had some sort of bearing on her future actions, but it's impossible to know if someone coming back from Pakistan and who's been attending a madrasa is necessarily going to be a violent extremist in the future. So it's something that we need to be very careful with, and I think one thing that it does draw attention to is that the fact that there's a term that keeps floating around regarding the San Bernardino attacks, self-radicalization. I don't think that that was the case. I think that that's a bit of a misnomer, actually. Clearly, there is a long process at work here and a set of factors, material and otherwise, that have contributed to these individuals' eventual embarking on carrying out the attacks that they did. And saying self-radicalization kind of implies that it happened in a bubble. Evidently, it did not happen in a bubble. And we need to make sure that we get our terminology lined up with the reality in order to avoid kind of making these mistakes again in future.
Why do you say it did not occur in a bubble?
Because in anyone's path towards becoming a radical, violent Islamist, there are external influences, even if these influences are offline or online, if they're not kind of happening in the real world, if they're happening on social media, that kind of thing. That's still an external influence. And it's really important to recognize that someone doesn't just go onto the internet, start kind of plugging into Islamic State propaganda online, and then suddenly, over a period of a few months, become a supporter of Islamic State. It's the human contact that actually leads to that kind of thing. So, yes, propaganda is very important, and Islamic State's propaganda itself is very important in this, because it does kind of empower people and make people kind of feel defiant in the face of the status quo, that kind of thing. But the propaganda alone is not the thing which is radicalizing people. It's the kind of purveyors of the jihadist ideology that are convincing individuals to go down this path, this trajectory. They're the issue. They're the kind of outreach officers that we need to be dealing with, as well as propaganda. But we just need to make sure that we look at it as a holistic issue rather than just kind of pinning the blame on social media corporations for letting propaganda be posted on their websites. It's much, much more than that.
So these could be contacts, say, at schools, but also, say, at mosques or friends or other types of contacts as well.
Absolutely. And the list can go on and on and on. And that's one of the things which is most difficult about this. But we have to kind of respect the fact that radicalization is something that cannot be generalized. There are lots and lots of different processes at work here, lots of different relationships that can lead to it. And yeah, often it will be contacts at mosques or friends. I mean, we've seen a lot of recruitment by friendship happening in Europe, specifically in view of Islamic State. People kind of from the same year at school going to join each other in Syria and Iraq because they've stayed in touch with their co-classmates who have gone to join the group. And then they're recruited from Syria and Iraq. But what's really important to recognize is that it's not, again, recruitment itself is also a bit of a misnomer, because it suggests that this is an on-off status, that you can just go from being a non-recruit to suddenly being a fully-fledged member of Islamic State or a fully-fledged violent extremist. It doesn't work like that. It's a much longer process, and there are a lot of different factors on the path towards becoming a fully-fledged violent extremist. And it's those factors, as well as the things which kind of set up the fertile ground for radicalization, that we need to be looking to deal with, not just kind of firefighting the propaganda or firefighting specific extremist preachers.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
That's all right. Thank you.
Charlie Winter, Senior Research Associate at the Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative at Georgia State University. He spoke to me from London. Well, joining me now with what is happening on the web concerning this story is VOA's Susan Yockey.
Thank you, Sarah. Hello, everybody. Alan Arbia tweets, U.S. shooter's Pakistan religious school condemns massacre. And most Americans see Muslims like any other group after California shooting. Mufti Ismail Menk tweets, terrorism has no faith and boundaries. Our thoughts are with victims and loved ones. Harris Zafar writes, Ahmadiyya Muslim community condemns the California shooting, extends condolences to victims, and prays for the speedy recovery of the injured. Freedom Fan says, Obama assured us Americans that if only we let him confiscate all our guns, his Muslim buddies would never kill again. Dalia Ghalem Yazbek tweets, woman involved in the California shooting, media puzzled. Violence by women is a fact. Stop being surprised. Women are not always victims. Real Liberty Media says, how is it possible all these people got shot in the California shooting at San Bernardino? Wasn't that a gun-free zone? Never mind. Excuse me. In other news, Dan Bilewski on the New York Times website reports that a South African court today granted bail to Oscar Pistorius, the Olympic star known as the Blade Runner, pending his sentencing for the killing of his girlfriend. It says under the terms of the bail, the 29-year-old double amputee athlete will remain under house arrest while he awaits sentencing at a hearing scheduled for April 8th. Tom Steinforth tweets, Oscar Pistorius's bail, 10,000 rand, rather farcical given his family's wealth. But Claire Phillips says, Oscar Pistorius' defense asking for bail at just 10,000 rand, he has no money. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That's International Edition's Susan Yockey. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Paleontologists have recently discovered one of this collection of dinosaur tracks on the Isle of Skye in Scotland. The assortment of tracks include hundreds of footprints made by giant plant-eating ancestors of the Brontosaurus. The dinosaur tracks, which are thought to be around 170 million years old, were found by the scientists in layers of rock, which they say was once the bottom of a shallow saltwater lagoon. Based on the size of the footprints, one as large as 70 centimeters in diameter, the researchers determined that the dinosaur probably grew to at least 15 meters in length and weighed more than 10 metric tons. The discovery of the Skye dinosaur tracks, along with the findings made in other parts of the world, suggests that the animals, who were thought to be mostly land dwellers, actually spent much of their time along coastal areas in shallow water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at a new film in the heart of the sea. Authorities in China's capital, Beijing, Tuesday issued their first ever red alert on air pollution. The city has readings of dangerous particles known as PM2.5 above 300 micrograms per cubic meter, about 10 times the safety level issued by the World Health Organization. The result has been traffic restrictions, voluntary school closures, and reductions or suspension of factory operations and work at construction sites. Several cities in nearby Hebei province have imposed emergency measures. Last week, a period of thick smog forced authorities in Beijing to issue orange alert. The current red alert is expected to last until midday Thursday, when colder air is expected to lift the smog. Shenghao Fang is a researcher for the Beijing-based China Policy Advisory Company. Speaking from the city of Changchun, northeast of Beijing, he told International Edition's Victor Beatty, imposition of the highest of four alert levels, a system only introduced 2 years ago, was an extraordinary step.
Beijing hasn't done so before. This is the first time Beijing is this red alert. And the Ministry of Environmental Protection is really serious about letting people know and allowing people to make adjustments. Schools now, due to realistic concerns for air quality, are doing the right thing. It's like the policy is giving people this opportunity to be able to make decisions.
This is an issue that has plagued the Chinese capital. Years have not their previous efforts worked?
Their previous efforts are working. You have to understand that this smog, it cannot be dealt with properly within a short period of time. Historically, big industrial cities like London, they all gone through this such long periods of bad air pollution. Beijing still have a long way to go in order to really solve its problems. But the government is making efforts and seriously imping the efforts. But how their efforts are going to be effective, what term and how fast, it's still yet to be seen.
This, of course, occurs mostly during the winter time because of the coal-fired power plants.
Coal-fired power plants is the biggest problem, especially in northern East China. But the situation in Beijing is slightly different. Beijing, they've already basically moved away all the coal-fired power plants, the big ones, from the city. So now they have gas-fired power plants. But the biggest problem are not the big ones, but the small ones, smaller and inefficient heating units that are privately used. I think these are the biggest problems. And because coal are so cheap at the moment, economically, people still, especially poor people, prefer to use coal and low-quality coal.
Well, Shenghao, this comes as world leaders are meeting in Paris for a climate change conference. Obviously, this underscores the concerns that China has about called greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes, definitely. But things are different. The climate change mitigation is more concerned of the total amount of carbon dioxide emissions. And that's almost the single most important contributor to climate change. But for domestic air pollution in the big cities like Beijing, causes are much more complex than carbon emissions. And to tackle domestic air pollution is the absolute priority in China. That being said, reducing the total amount of emissions is also important. It's just not at the moment, people can't see through the smog to see that the globe is really warming. So the policy orientation will be controlling the air pollution in the big cities.
That's Chenghao Feng of China Policy. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. The 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is is International Edition, a new film from Academy Award-winning director Ron Howard in The Heart of the Sea, stars Chris Hemsworth as the first mate of an ill-fated whaling ship. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the movie looks at the story that inspired Herman Melville's literary classic, Moby Dick.
In the autumn of 1820, the whaler Essex and its crew set off to find and harvest whales. Whale oil powered the Industrial Revolution and lighted the world's cities. The Nantucket-based Essex sailed first to South America, but finding the hunt poor, headed to the middle of the Pacific. By November 20th, the ship's crew had harpooned whales, but one of their boats had been damaged. As First Mate Owen, played in the film by Chris Hemsworth, was repairing the damaged boat, a huge male sperm whale rammed and sank the Essex.
Mr. Chase!
God damn it.
Find Mr.
What happened next became the stuff of nightmares. Chase, the Essex's Captain George Pollard Jr., and their remaining crew spent 3 months in the middle of the Pacific. Before the survivors were rescued, they would resort to cannibalism to stay alive. To portray their ordeal, Hemsworth, normally known for his massive physique as the Marvel comic hero Thor, had on a 500-calorie-a-day diet. A photo of the emaciated Australian actor went viral on Instagram. At the film's premiere, he said that everyone was dedicated to showing the suffering of the men of the Essex.
Yeah, we wanted to sort of show a frame of the film and what we were going through and a portion of sort of what that experience was like. And, it was hard work getting down to that weight for all of us, but a pretty tight unit. You know, all the cast were doing it, so it was a lot of support as opposed to doing it on your own.
Tom Holland, who young seaman Thomas Nickerson, says that the director, Ron Howard, strove for authenticity in everything, which meant that everyone looked like they were starving.
This is a true story about real people, and we had a duty as actors to do justice to these characters, and made sure that every aspect of this film was authentic, so that meant we had to starve, learn how to sail, really go out to sea. So it was pretty grueling, but, you know, all for a good reason.
In The Heart of the Sea is being released, Japan is sending whaling ships to the Antarctic in a controversial culling, which Tokyo says is scientific research. Director Ron Howard says his movie does not aim to glorify killing whales, but take its time.
Obviously, you look at our movie through the prism of history, but I think if you also watch it, you'll see that it's not a pro-whaling movie that's meant to romanticize the process. It acknowledges the brutality, but it also recognizes the truth that was the energy industry. Hey, and that's kind of a shocking thing to think about.
In The Heart of the Sea also stars Ben Whishaw as a young Herman Melville, who would later use the Essex's sinking as the inspiration for his novel, Moby Dick. The movie is rated PG, violence and thematic elements. In the Heart of the Sea opens in the United States December 11th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Music from the new film, In the Heart of the Sea. It looks like it'll be really interesting. Well, Pope Francis has a holy year dedicated to showing the church's merciful side amid unprecedented security aimed at thwarting the threat of a Paris-style attack on the Vatican. Tens of thousands of faithful backed up for blocks at the Vatican on Tuesday, undergoing the strictest security checks in living memory as Pope Francis began the Roman Catholic Church's holy year. Following the Mass, Francis officially started the year-long event, also known as Jubilee, by opening the usually bricked-up Holy Door of St. Peter's Basilica. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 10:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is violence directed against women because they are women, or violence that affects primarily women and girls. They are human rights violations committed against women that stem from discrimination and gender inequality, and the failure of governments and societies to recognize the human rights of women and girls. Globally, over one-third of women and girls experience some form of physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. Violence against women takes many forms and goes far beyond rape and physical intimidation. Every girl who was married off too young, every wife who was beaten by her husband or in-laws, every woman or girl who was trafficked into sexual exploitation is a victim of gender-based violence. Girls and women who are subjected to sexual violence in war zones, honor killing, psychological abuse, such as harassment and intimidation, are victims of gender-based violence. All forms of gender-based violence are unacceptable violations of human rights, but together they form an enormous obstacle to gender equality, economic development, security, and true human progress. The 2 weeks between November 25th, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, and December 10th, Human Rights Day, are dedicated to 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. 16 days of campaigning around the world to challenge and raise awareness of gender-based violence and mobilize people everywhere to bring about change. This year's theme is From Peace in the Home to Peace in the World, Make Education Safe for All. The root causes of violence against women and girls include gender stereotypes, perceived gender roles, and social norms. These perceptions are formed early in childhood. Only through education can we hope to change them. This means that girls and women must be able to obtain an education so they and their children can lead better lives. It means creating a safe, hygienic school environment for them and removing obstacles that cut their education short, such as domestic work or early marriage. And it means that boys and men must be taught to engage in preventing violence against women and promoting gender equality. Gender-based violence is inevitable. It is a choice. It can and must be prevented, and the time is now.
That was an editorial reflecting views of the United States government.